Please bow your hearts with me as we approach now 2 Samuel 5:17 through 6:23. Our God, we once again confess together that we are more blessed than we even know to gather together around the God who speaks to us, the God who initiates to draw near to us, and has continued to speak to us even when we have so blatantly trespassed against you so often in our lives. We gather around the God of grace, whose word is power, and who keeps his sheep, and who keeps his promises, and will bring us home to glory. And so as we consider this passage where David's rule is set up in Jerusalem, we look to the past to be encouraged in how you will bring us to your new Jerusalem, and to marvel at the grace that will do this and is doing this. So please, strengthen our worship, strengthen our faith. Help us to give you the attention you're due as you speak to us in your word. Help me to speak only what is true. Help us all to understand well, to listen humbly, and to remember. We ask this through Jesus. Amen. Well, I'm not going to read all the way through the passage at the beginning, mainly because I'm wondering if this is a little too big of a chunk to be diving into anyway, and we're going to be crunched for time. But 2 Samuel chapter 5, 17 through chapter 6, verse 23, we're calling this sermon, "A Fear is Reinforced." A fear is reinforced. And we're going to go through this passage in three main movements, with each of them involving David having some good motives, but varying levels of obedience. How many of you have ever been playing a game that you thought you knew the rules for, maybe a board game, a table game, and you're going along and suddenly you run into a snag and you realize, wait a minute, I don't think I knew the rules as well as I thought I did, and so you start reading them and find out you're doing a whole bunch of things wrong in the game. Any of you ever done that? There's more serious situations, maybe in a relationship with someone, where you think you understand what they will appreciate in the relationship, and then you step across a line that you didn't even know was there, and suddenly you've angered them, and all of a sudden the room gets really cold, and you're not really sure why. And finally, if you work on communicating, you'll begin to understand how you could have helped them more, and hopefully they will come to understand you were really trying to do well. But in those situations, sometimes that you were trying to do well, or that you were trying to play by the rules, isn't enough, right? You need to slow down and listen and understand how things are supposed to be done if there's going to be blessing. Now, both of those examples are trivial, are very light compared to the kind of situation in which David finds himself. He is a man who is generally characterized by being a man after God's own heart. He wants to do God's will. He wants to please the Lord as much as anyone else, perhaps in the history of Israel to that point. That characterizes him. And yet, he is not above overlooking things. He is not above wandering from the way in which he ought to be living. And in this passage, God is going to bless David and the nation by reminding them how carefully attentive they must be to his will and ways. Because, as you'll see in our central theme, God's fearsome holiness brings terror to his enemies, but joy to his faithful people. God's fearsome holiness brings terror to his enemies, but joy to his faithful people. God is going to remind David and the whole nation the blessing of being his faithful people and the terror of straying from his ways, because he's going to remind them of his glory. So let's consider how he does this through three main movements. We're first going to see terror in Philistia. Then we're going to see terror in Israel. Then we're going to see joy in Israel. First of all, terror in Philistia. Let me read for us verses 17 through 25 at the end of chapter 5. When the Philistines learned that David had been anointed king over Israel, all the Philistines went up to search for David. But David heard of it and went down to the stronghold. Now the Philistines had come and spread out in the valley of Rephaim. David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I go up against the Philistines? Will you give them into my hand?" And the Lord said to David, "Go up, for I will certainly give the Philistines into your hand." And David came to Baal Perazim, and David defeated them there. And he said, "The Lord has burst through my enemies before me like a bursting flood." Therefore the name of that place is called Baal Perazim, which means Lord of Breaking Through. And the Philistines left their idols there, and David and his men carried them away. And the Philistines came up yet again and spread out in the valley of Rephaim. And when David inquired of the Lord, the Lord said, "You shall not go up. Go around to their rear and come against them opposite the balsam trees. And when you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the balsam trees, then rouse yourself, for then the Lord has gone out before you to strike down the army of the Philistines." And David did as the Lord commanded him, and struck down the Philistines from Geba to Gezer. Well, we heard last week, as Jonah preached for us from the beginning of chapter 5, how David had finally been embraced as king by the entire nation. All the tribes had come to him and said, "You are our bone and our flesh, and we want you to be our king." They entered into a covenant with David, that bone and flesh reference just illustrating how closely they wanted to be unified with him. And then we saw also last week how David went and conquered Jerusalem, the city of the Jebusites that had previously been unconquerable by the nation of Israel. I'll allude to that in just a minute. And so in this time now, David has finally become king. The year is right around 1010 BC, about 1,000 years before Christ. And David is setting up his capital in Jerusalem. It was a brilliant political move. He chose a location that had previously been unconquered and conquered it. That location was in the tribal territory of Benjamin, which was the land of the previous king. So any who still may have had loyalties to Saul, some of those fears or concerns would have been alleviated by David choosing his capital place in that tribal land. It was also right on the border between Judah and the northern tribes, centrally located for the nation. It was a good political choice for where to be. And as we go on, we'll also see that it was a good religious choice for where to be. More on that later. David over Judah by itself hadn't been terribly threatening, but now over a unified nation making these wise moves, David is becoming an intimidating opponent for the Philistines. And so they begin to gather their forces against him. It says that at first he goes down from Jerusalem to what is called the stronghold. We don't know exactly where that is, but it seems he was probably choosing a better military position. from which to fight the Philistines. Jerusalem was not quite yet made ready as he would like it to be for defending that. It's always better to choose your own battlefield, and it seems like that's what David does. But before he just runs down into battle with the Philistines, he stops to ask God for directions. In fact, in both of these battles against the Philistines, we see that he stops to ask God, "Do you want me to go? How do you want me to go?" Now, this is really important, and I'm going to mention how important it is to see this quality in David. But right away, you might notice a contrast from what we saw last week in the beginning of chapter 5. Because there's no record of David asking God any specific directions about whether he should go out and drive out the Jebusites in Jerusalem. Why not? Is David inconsistent here? And if we're going to make a big deal of David asking God for directions here in the end of chapter 5, there must be a good explanation for why he didn't at the beginning. I think the reason is he already knew God's will. God had already clearly spoken about his plan for the Jebusites and for Jerusalem. All the way back in Genesis 15, verses 18 through 21, on the day that God had cut a covenant with Abraham, you might remember that familiar scene, he had said, "To your offspring I will give this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates." And he refers to the people who will be driven out before Abraham's family, and in Genesis 15:21, at the end, he specifically mentions the Jebusites. So, the Jebusites were one of seven particular nations that keep getting mentioned over and over again as the ones that were supposed to be driven out by God's people. Again, in Joshua chapter 3, when Joshua had taken over as the new leader after Moses, in verses 10 and 11 of Joshua 3, Joshua says to the people, encouraging them, "Here is how you shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will without fail drive out before you the Canaanites, the Hivites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, and the Jebusites. Behold, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth is passing over before you into the Jordan." So once again, that the Jebusites are mentioned, and then, but this had not yet been done. It was God's stated will, but Joshua 15:63 specifically mentions how the people of Benjamin had not been able to drive out the Jebusites from Jerusalem. So the reason David hadn't stopped to ask God is he already knew God's direction on that. Yeah, get them out of there. And as Jonah covered last week, he had a brilliant battle strategy for how to get through the defenses of the city. So we should typically expect that God's will for us is to finish what we start, unless it was sin. Finishing what we start reflects God's faithfulness, the God who always keeps his promises and is continually finishing what he has started. It might be as little as a painting project. It might be as monumental as a marriage. But we need to be people who finish what we start. And David knew that that was God's will for them. And that's why they finished the job in Jerusalem. They weren't going to accept a half-finished conquest or only partly finished conquest. But now in this second part of the chapter, the Philistines are not one of those seven specific nations that Israel was told to drive out. They live along the coast west of Israel. However, by opposing David and by continually opposing the Israelite people, they have now placed themselves in the line of divine fire. They are making themselves God's enemies. Remember the familiar words of Psalm 2. "Why do the nations rage and the people plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, 'Let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us.' He who sits in the heavens laughs." the Lord holds them in derision. The Philistines think that if they're ever going to be able to oppose David, as he's only growing stronger, now is the time. And so they come, march right into the middle of Israel once again. It was a strategy that had worked when Saul was king. And they hoped to divide Israel north from south and thwart David's rising power. They come and choose the battle place, the Valley of the Rephaim, in which they had fought Joshua twice before. This was in some ways advantageous for the Philistines. Remember that they had more advanced weaponry than many of the nations around them, including chariots, that weren't as effective in mountainous areas, but in a valley like that, they would have, you would think, had the military advantage. But when you're going up against not just God's anointed king, but God himself, all the military weaponry in the world is of no real advantage. We see how, in the first instance, in the battle recorded in up through verse 21, David and his military force comes sweeping down out of the hill country, bursts through the Philistine lines, and defeats them so thoroughly that the Philistines leave their idols and so many of their other possessions leaving behind them and just go on the run. If you want more commentary, not just on this particular story, but on everything we're going to talk about, you might jot down 1 Chronicles chapters 13 through 16 and go read those later today. It's a parallel account that gives some different details of all of these stories. And one of the details that's filled in there is that David and his men not only carried away these idols, but they also burned them. They weren't keeping them to worship them. They were keeping them to destroy them. And so the Philistines are completely overthrown, and God and David names the place Baal Perazim, Lord of Breaking Through. He exults in the God who can just effortlessly break through enemy lines. Then in the second instance, the Philistines come again, but notice David stops again to ask God for directions. He doesn't assume that because God worked one way in the past in a particular situation that God's going to work exactly the same way again. He doesn't presume to know God's designs. He carefully seeks God's design for that particular moment in life. And it's not the main point of the passage, but I think it's a commendable example for us to follow, that we see not only in David, but we see it most specifically in our Lord Jesus, continually seeking communion with God to know his particular will for that day and for that moment. A God who is glorious in holiness is not just a God to be consulted when I don't have a plan and I need to have one. A God so glorious in holiness is a God to be consulted even when I do have a plan, but I know his is better. People who love and worship this God are people who habitually, instinctively ask him for direction. Maybe saying, God, I think that this is right, based on what I know of how you've acted before, based on how you've led me before, I think this may be right, but please correct me if you have another plan. That's how David prays, and this time God gives him a different direction. And so instead of a front-on assault, God tells them to go around behind the enemy and come against them opposite the balsam trees. If people were familiar with this particular area at the time, it would make geographical sense to them in a way that it doesn't to us. But here's the main thing about God's strategy the second time. In verse 24, he tells David, waiting for the sound of marching in the tops of the trees. How many of you kids have ever heard the sound of marching in the tops of trees? That's not a sound you ever hear, is it? You might hear the wind rustling through trees. You might on some sad occasions hear branches snapping in trees. You don't hear the sound of marching. What's going on here? Well, I think the sound is meant to indicate God is telling David, I'm going on the warpath. If there was any confusion about who's ultimately the one marching against the Philistines, it's me. It's not you and your 30,000 man army. It's me. We'll see this later as well. I just want to mention a few of these really cool instances from later on in Scripture. In Second, by the way, I'm looking forward someday to going through Kings. There's a lot of just fascinating stories. That would be really fun to dig in more. But I was reminded of a few of them here. In 2 Kings chapter 7, during the ministry of the prophet Elisha, as the nation of Israel is wandering further and further away from God, has even been divided, the Syrian king Ben-Hadad laid siege to the northern part of it, of the Hebrews, the nation of Israel. He laid siege to their capital city, Samaria. And people were so starved by the end of this siege that they were even resorting to cannibalism of children. An absolutely grotesque scene. An absolutely hopeless scene for the Israelites. But you might remember the story. Eventually, some desperate lepers go to sneak out and beg for mercy, figuring, we're going to die in here, either of disease or starvation. We might as well go out and die at the hands of the Syrians. But here's how 2 Kings 7, starting in verse 5, reads. When they came to the edge of the camp of the Syrians, behold, there was no one there. For the Lord had made the army of the Syrians hear the sound of chariots and of horses, the sound of a great army, so that they said to one another, behold, the king of Israel has hired against us the kings of the Hittites and the kings of Egypt to come against us. So they fled away in the twilight and abandoned their tents and their horses and their donkeys, leaving the camp as it was, and fled for their lives. The merciful and gracious God had decided to be even more patient with that rebellious nation and overthrew their enemies without a fight and made provision for them. The whole camp was left full of food and provisions for a starving city. So that's one specific instance where the sound of God being on the war path showed up prominently. There's other accounts as well. You might remember at the end in Joshua 5, when before the Battle of Jericho, Joshua met an unknown armed warrior and asked him, are you for us or for our adversaries? And the response he got from this one was, no, but I am the commander of the army of the Lord. Now I have come. There's debate about whether this is an appearance of the Lord, of God's Son, you know, before he came incarnate, or if it was an angelic warrior, what it was. But the point is, this is the one who commands the angelic hosts of the armies of the Lord. And his response to Joshua was basically, you're asking the wrong question. You should be asking if you're on my side. That's what really matters. Are you for us or for our adversaries? No. I'm the commander of the armies of the Lord. Are you on my side? This is the warrior God that we serve. This is the King of glory. Later on again in 2 Kings chapter 6, verses 15 to 17, a Syrian king, another one, had sent an army to capture Elisha because Elisha kept prophetically revealing battle plans to Israel and thwarting the Syrian king's plans. And we read this in 2 Kings 6, 15 to 17. When the servant of the man of God rose early in the morning and went out, behold, an army with horses and chariots was all around the city. So this is the army of Syrians that's coming to capture Elisha. And the servant said, "Alas, my master, what shall we do?" Elisha said, "Do not be afraid, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." Then Elisha prayed and said, "O Lord, please open his eyes that he may see." So the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. We serve the God who commands mighty hosts that we can't see or imagine. This is the God who goes before his people, who surrounds his people, who is always with us, whether we feel like we're winning or losing. God is not losing. He is always working out his perfect plans. And this is the God who goes before David in this battle against the Philistines. And so, as we see in verse 26, well, let me read the end of verse 24. "For then the Lord has gone out before you to strike down the army of the Philistines," when you hear this sound. "And David did as the Lord commanded him, and he struck down the Philistines from Geba to Gezer." When it refers to a battle that takes place between one city and another, it's referring to a complete drubbing. The Philistines were on the run, and Israel's army kept chasing them and kept beating them until there was no army left to beat. And why was it? It was because God went before them. The God of breaking through. And so there was terror in Philistia. David, as he was following God's will, as he was following God's word, was an unstoppable force for the good of God's people and for the glory of God's name. And so that's point number one, terror in Philistia. God's fearsome holiness brings terror to his enemies, but joy to his faithful people. Now, I want to read you a passage. I'm not going to tell you the reference right away. And I'm going to take out some names that are in there, and I'm curious who you think this is referring to. The prophet spoke to the Lord, saying, "Let the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, appoint a man over the congregation, who shall go out before them and come in before them, who shall lead them out and bring them in, that the congregation of the Lord may not be as sheep that have no shepherd." So the Lord said to the prophet, "Take this one, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hand on him. Make him stand before the priest and all the congregation, and you shall commission him in their sight. You shall invest him with some of your authority, that all the congregation of the people of Israel may obey. And he shall stand before the priest, who shall inquire for him by the judgment of the Urim before the Lord. At his word they shall go out, and at his word they shall come in, both he and all the people of Israel with him, the whole congregation." All right, so who is that written about? Any guesses? All right, it sounds a lot like David, doesn't it? You almost might think that this is something inserted here in the book of Samuel. But it's actually from the book of Numbers. The prophet was Moses, and the leader was Joshua. God was preparing for Joshua, Yeshua. Another one who gives us beautiful glimpses of Jesus, the conquering king. As God was preparing for Joshua to succeed Moses and lead the nation of Israel on their conquest of the promised land, what we're seeing here, my point in reading that, is that David is beginning to look an awful lot like Joshua. He's following the Lord, empowered by his Spirit, going out, coming in before the people, leading them in finishing the conquests that had not quite been finished under Joshua. It's a glorious time. David has, in God's timing, taken the throne, gone on the march, led even by supernatural experiences, just as Joshua before him, and God's enemies were being overthrown. And by the way, this would happen again. David's great son Jesus would also eventually take his throne in God's time, after careful waiting. And then, what does the book of Acts describe? The book of Acts describes how Jesus, after taking his throne, after ascending back to heaven, he went on the march. And what did the apostles do? They were told to go and wait, and I'll give you your directions. And when did they get their directions? When another supernatural noise, the sound of a mighty rushing wind, swept through the room where they were gathered in the city in which they were staying, Jerusalem, and they were sent out to preach the good news. And God began to powerfully gather his people together and build his church in Jerusalem. And so, in what God is doing through David, we're seeing how his fearsome holiness brings terror to his enemies, but joy to his faithful people. It's not just at this point in history. It's the way it will always be for God's people. Well, we wish it could remain as jubilant and triumphant going into the next chapter as it was in chapter 15. But it doesn't. Next, we'll see terror in Israel. Let me read verses 1 through 10 of chapter 6. David again gathered all the chosen men of Israel, 30,000. You might be expecting, all right, he's going to go on another military campaign. Well, that wasn't his point this time. David arose and went with all the people who were with him from Baal Judah to bring up from there the Ark of God, which is called by the name of the Lord of hosts, who sits enthroned on the cherubim. And they carried the Ark of God on a new cart and brought it out of the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. And Uzzah and Ahio, the sons of Abinadab, were driving the new cart with the Ark of God, and Ahio went before the Ark. We'll pause there for now. David has been setting up his political center in Jerusalem, and now he also wants to make Israel his religious center, to unite the political and religious centers in God's place. And in God's kingdom, this move makes sense. The city of Jerusalem had always had a special significance, and we could go all the way back. We don't have time for it now, but we could go all the way back to Genesis 14, when Abraham met Melchizedek, this mysterious figure who was a priest king. He was called a priest of the Lord Most High. And I actually have the chapter wrong. It was later in Genesis than that. Abraham met him after having, I believe, won the battle against the people who had taken Lot and those from Sodom and Gomorrah into captivity. It was after that successful battle where Abraham and his 318 or 319 people, soldiers from his household went out and led a successful rescue campaign. It was after that he met Melchizedek, And he paid tithes to Melchizedek out of the spoil from that battle. He didn't keep anything else, but he did give tithes to Melchizedek. But Melchizedek was not just a priest king. It was said he was the king of Salem, which is Jerusalem. And so, all the way back from hundreds and hundreds of years before, in the days of Abraham, there had been a mysterious yet significant prominence to this city. It was as if it was the place on which God has set his sights all the way back then. And it's interesting then that it was the last place to be conquered in the Promised Land. It's as if the forces of God's enemies had staked all their interest. At least we're going to defend this place. But David has now claimed it. And so, David wants to now bring the Ark of the Covenant into this holy city, uniting the political and religious center in Israel. You remember what the Ark was, right? That relatively small wooden box, 2.5 feet by 3.5 feet. Not all that large, made of acacia wood, overlaid with gold. Beautiful and ornate. Containing the Ten Commandments, the tablets on which the Ten Commandments were written, symbolizing Israel needing to be led by God's Word, the importance of God's Word leading His people. Also containing Aaron's rod that had budded, and a container of manna, reminding the Israelites how God had provided for them and led them in their exodus and in their journey to freedom. So this, and not only that, but crowned with the mercy seat, where as this ark was kept in the most holy place of the tabernacle, once a year the blood of the sacrifice of the Day of Atonement would be sprinkled on that mercy seat. This ark represented the throne of God. In some places it's called the footstool of God's throne. It was so special. It was such a powerful representation of God's holy presence that it was never to be looked upon by anyone but the high priest once a year. Whenever it was transported, it was supposed to be transported on the shoulders of the Kohathites, which was a group of the tribe of Levi, the ones who ministered in the tabernacle. It was only to be carried on poles that were run through brackets on the sides of the Ark of the Covenant, and it was always to be covered, because God specifically said, if anyone looks on it or touches it, he will die. In fact, the high priest never even touched it. They just sprinkled the blood of the sacrifice on it. Those specific instructions, if you want to go back and read them later, are laid out in Numbers chapter 4 and chapter 7. That'd be some more good homework reading for this afternoon or later this week. Numbers chapter 4 and Numbers chapter 7. There was a holy fear of mistreating this ark in the past, in Israel's past. Back in 1 Samuel chapter 6, you remember the Philistines had captured this ark in battle, and after they tried to use it as a magic token to give them success, and God progressively destroyed them more and more and cast down Dagon in his own temple, the Philistines decided to send it back to Israel on a cart pulled by two cows. And when it came back to Israel, we see this account, starting in 1 Samuel 6:19. And he, God, struck some of the men of Beth Shemesh, because they looked upon the ark of the Lord. He struck 70 men of them, and the people mourned because the Lord had struck the people with a great blow. Then the men of Beth Shemesh said, who is able to stand before the Lord, this holy God? And to whom shall we go up away from us? So they sent messengers to the inhabitants of Kiriath-Jearim, saying, "The Philistines have returned the ark of the Lord. Come down and take it up to you." And the men of Kiriath-Jearim came and took up the ark of the Lord and brought it to the house of Amminadab on the hill. They consecrated his son Eleazar to have charge of the ark of the Lord. From that day the ark was lodged at Kiriath-Jearim. A long time passed, some 20 years, and all the house of Israel lamented after the Lord. We see reference to a site here, Baal Judah. That was a name that was later given to the same place, Kiriath-Jearim. So the ark is still in that same place where it had been at the beginning of the book of Samuel. It had been 20 years of mourning before Israel had decided to turn to the Lord. Not too long after that, God had given them Saul as a king. Saul had a reign of decades. And then David had taken over. So it has perhaps been 70 years that the Ark of the Covenant has been in storage, you might say, in Kiriath-Jearim, Baal Judah. I'm sure it had been forgotten by many in Israel, but it has not been forgotten by David. And so, with a very commendable desire to restore God's design for his worship, David leads this 30,000 man march to go and take the ark and bring it to Jerusalem. We don't know why they so tragically disregarded some of those instructions that I mentioned for how the ark was to be transported. Maybe they reasoned that a new cart had worked pretty well for the Philistines in 1 Samuel 6. We'll try that. It was a 9 or 10 mile journey to get from where it was at Kiriath-Jearim to Jerusalem. Maybe they thought that's a pretty long ways for four guys to carry this thing. We don't know. But God had been clear in Numbers 4 and 7 about his expectations. The Ark of the Covenant that represented his holy, high and holy throne was not to be transported on a cart like a Philistine might transport their idols. Not even a new cart. Royalty like God was to be carried as in a litter on poles. You've seen those pictures of royalty in the Middle East being carried with a covering so just not anybody can see them, unless they want to be seen, on poles. That was the way God was to be carried. There's a fitting way to transport, so to speak, dignitaries. What Israel was doing, even though it was a new cart, this would be like transporting the president in the back of a pickup. Even if it's a new pickup, it's not the fitting way to transport the president. God had said how he wanted to be carried. How he wanted his ark to be carried. So in using a cart, they were treating the ark like pagans treated their gods. And so amid all their good intentions at honoring God, they had not paid attention to the rules. I wonder how long it would have been if the incident that's recorded here hadn't happened before God had ultimately let them know this isn't okay. I think one way or another he would have. Or perhaps the ox stumbling was exactly according to God's design, so that he could teach them something about his holiness. David and all the house of Israel were making merry before the Lord with songs and lyres and harps and tambourines and castanets and cymbals. And when they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah put out his hand to the ark of God and took hold of it, for the oxen stumbled. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Uzzah. And God struck him down there because of his error, and he died there beside the ark of God. And David was angry because the Lord had burst forth against Uzzah. And that place is called Here is Uzzah, which means the breaking out against Uzzah to this day. And David was afraid of the Lord that day, and he said, "How can the ark of the Lord come to me?" So David was not willing to take the ark of the Lord into the city of David. But David took it aside to the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite. Now, I hope that none of us is too quick to jump all over Uzzah for what he did. I can't imagine that I, in that situation, if I had accepted the position of walking beside the cart, and the ox stumbled and the cart shifted and it looked like this ark was going to fall, I can't imagine I would have done anything different than to try to put out my hand and stop it. Do you want to see the Ark of the Covenant lying smashed on the ground? Do you want to see it fall in the mud or the dust? It was an instinctive response, but it was a response that flowed out of a pattern of disobedience that had preceded it in how the ark was to be carried. And so people will make observations about Uzzah's heart in the whole thing, and perhaps they're true. R.C. Sproul, in his book The Holiness of God, said Uzzah assumed that his hand was less polluted than the earth, so he wanted the ark to keep from falling and getting dirty. As I mentioned, he might have also been concerned about it getting broken. Another man said Uzzah's mistake was assuming that his hand was more preferable, was more honorable to God than the dirt was. But the fact was that the dirt had never disobeyed God. Not once in its existence. The dirt was more able to stand in the presence of God's holiness than was Uzzah, contaminated as he was by sin. And that is true. I also learned that both of those thoughts really originated with Jonathan Edwards, who perhaps said it first. So if we're going to give proper citations to everybody, go back to Jonathan Edwards. But it was an instinctive response on Uzzah's heart that, or on Uzzah's part, that probably did flow out, certainly did flow out of a heart condition that was not properly revering God's holiness. Uzzah never should have been there in the first place. If he was, he should have been carrying the ark on poles. Now, I think Uzzah, like David, was trying to do a good thing, but he'd been careless with the holiness of God. In a time when Israel was experiencing great blessing, was growing in might, was feared by their enemies, was treasured as an ally by their friends, the time when David's military strength was growing greater, it was easy for them to presume, God must like us. We must deserve God's blessing. And they had perhaps lost their appreciation just a bit for the fact that it's only by God's gracious mercy that anyone can be in his presence, that anyone can receive his blessing. So, I think Uzzah may very well be in heaven. We have every reason to think that he had taken carefully his responsibility to watch over the ark while it was in his hometown, and that he, like everyone else, had been negligent. However, his judgment was a lesson for God's people. In striking Uzzah down, God was doing good to the nation of Israel, reminding them who he was. That they were not entitled for him to go out before them and strike down their enemies. Instead, what they really deserved was to be struck down in the presence of a holy God. that it was only by the mercy of atoning sacrifice that they could abide having him among them. As one man has said, we can't envision God, not Israel then, and certainly not us now. We can't envision God as if he's an elderly relative in a nursing home that's just thrilled that someone cared to drop by. That's not the way we approach God. He is the glorious King of the universe, high and holy, perfect in righteousness, who cannot abide sin in his presence. Modern Christianity tends to take a very casual approach to God. They think that being intimate and close to God means that I can be very careless with him, very casual with him. But there is an appropriate level of formality in how we approach God. That's why our gathered worship services tend to have an order to them. Why? Because there's an appropriate formality in how we approach God. We need to be reminded of that. God has given us instructions on his design for orderly worship gatherings of his people, and we want to carefully follow them. Now, this doesn't mean that there's no place for a more casual intimacy with God. Certainly throughout the day-to-day, very personal moments of our lives, God is there with us, and he invites us to come to him in any situation. But the heart with which we come to him, as much as we are delighting in him as a close and loving father, is still one of reverence. God is the one who gets to decide how he is pleased to be worshipped. Israel had neglected that. We must not. Now, we could leave the message off right there, and it would end at, it would still be a little bit of a long sermon. But it would be a dreadfully legalistic one, perhaps. Because this isn't primarily about our forms of worship. I don't want us to leave on the note of saying God expects to be worshipped in the right way, and then therefore leave us with the impression that if we worship God in the right way, with the right public forms, then God will be okay with us. No, that's pagan religion. It is true that God gets to decide how he is to be worshipped. It is true that we should pay attention to this, but that's not what makes us righteous before him. The forms of worship God has given us are designed to point us to what? To the way in which we can be made righteous before God, which is Jesus. And we'll start to head that way in our final section, joy in Israel. God's fearsome holiness brings terror to his enemies, but joy to his faithful people. Well, we've seen terror to the Philistines. We've seen terror in Israel as his people mistakenly acted unfaithfully. But now we're going to see God continue his covenant grace toward them. Remember, the ark has been left in the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite, who doesn't appear to have been actually a Jew. He was someone else living there. Maybe David thought, well, let's just see how it goes with him here. Better than having God judge another Israelite. We don't know for sure what David's motives were, but the ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite 3 months. And the Lord blessed Obed-Edom and all his household. And it was told King David, "The Lord has blessed the household of Obed-Edom and all that belongs to him because of the ark of God." So David went and brought up the ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with rejoicing. Imagine Obed-Edom's fear when this terribly dangerous footstool of God was brought into his house. A man had just gotten killed for touching it. Imagine the reverent fear of the Lord that possessed Obed-Edom's household for that next 3 months. They must have been the three holiest months of his life. And they were the three most blessed. Brothers and sisters, that's the way it is with God. The path to blessing is a path of holiness. We are too often tempted to believe the lie that holiness is a drudgery and a curse and a trial. No, holiness is a blessing. And it was for the house of Obed-Edom. To have God at the center of every decision, of every thought, to have God at the center of your life is the path of blessing. A reverential fear of the God who can bless or can curse. As one man said, being near God is not safe, but there's nowhere better to be. Being near God is not safe, but there's nowhere better to be. The warnings God gives are because of His mercy. They're not designed to keep us away from Him. They're designed to draw us near to Him safely. That's how God works with His people. He doesn't warn us about His holiness and His judgment of sin in order to keep us away. He warns us so that we may draw near to Him safely by the way He has designed. And His presence has now been a blessing to the household of Obed-Edom. Brothers and sisters, we have the very Spirit of God within us. We don't just have the Ark of the Covenant in our household. We have the very Spirit of God with us within our very bodies. How grateful we must be for the once and for all sacrifice that made this possible. Made it possible for us to be so near to God without being destroyed. What a privileged people we are. What a blessed people we are. And how much more does our condition demand holiness than did that of Obed-Edom? To have God's very Spirit within us. What a privilege and what a responsibility, which is why Hebrews 12 says this, starting in verse 18. You have not come to what may be touched, a blazing fire and darkness and gloom and a tempest and the sound of a trumpet and the voice of whose words made the hearers beg that no further message be spoken to them. It's talking about when God first gave the law to them through Moses on Mount Sinai. But you have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, to the heavenly Jerusalem, to innumerable angels in festal gathering, and to the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. See that you do not refuse him who is speaking. For if they did not escape when they refused him who warned them from earth, much less will we escape if we reject him who warned us from heaven. You might go and meditate over that whole second half of that chapter also later today. You're getting a lot of homework. The point is that God is to be feared. And among those who revere him, that fear is a joyful experience. Among those who are careless toward him, it is a terrifying thing, or eventually will be. But what God is doing is he's reminding David, the fear of me doesn't need to be terror. The fear of me can be joy. Look at the household of Obed-Edom. Eventually, David hears about this and regains his courage. I think he had really wrestled with what exactly had happened. You remember, as I read through there, it said that at first David was angry about what had happened with Uzzah. We don't know if he was angry at God or if he was angry at himself for not more carefully administrating what had happened. If he was angry at other people who had neglected God's careful instructions in the law. We don't know who he was angry at, but ultimately it quickly led to a terror on David's part and an assumption that he couldn't have God near him. It was too dangerous. But then, in seeing how God blessed the household of Obed-Edom, David takes courage. I would imagine that during those 3 months, David was studying the law carefully. What did we miss? What did we do wrong? The grief that must have struck him as he perhaps read those chapters in Numbers. But now, as we move on through the chapter, David has realized what we needed was just a careful fear of the Lord. And so listen to how they proceed the second time around. David went and brought up the Ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with rejoicing. And when those who bore the Ark of the Lord had gone 6 steps, he sacrificed an ox and a fattened animal. So now they're carrying the Ark. You can hear it's now being borne by people, not by a cart. And they only get 6 steps down the road from Obed-Edom's house and they offer a sacrifice. David's saying, yes, I know that. I remember now, I'm paying careful attention to how God does draw us to come near to Him, but only through an atoning sacrifice. Now, commentators differ on whether every 6 steps the whole way into Jerusalem was a sacrifice offered or just at the very beginning. This place where the accident with where the tragedy with Uzzah had happened, many people think was right outside of Jerusalem, so it wasn't like they still had many, many miles to go. It might not have been as many sacrifices as it seems like, but it was still an extravagant amount of sacrifice, if that was the case, because David has a renewed appreciation of the fear of the Lord. And David danced before the Lord with all his might. And David was wearing a linen ephod. That was just supposed to designate a particular servant of the Lord. That's what the ephod was meant to indicate. When the priests wore an ephod, it meant to indicate that they belonged to the Lord and they served Him. So David is stating the same thing in what he's wearing. So David and all the house of Israel brought up the Ark of the Lord with shouting and with the sound of horn. Bringing back the shofar as well into the procession of the Ark of the Covenant as it had been in the days of Joshua. You can see David and those who were with him had gone back and read their Bibles. And they're going to worship God the way God said to be worshipped. And they have great joy in doing so. David would write in Psalm 2 later on in verses 10 through 12, "Now therefore, O kings, be wise. Be warned, O rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling." I think that's what David is doing here. There is great joy at the same time as there is a reverence and a fearsome God. Those two can go together. In fact, the greatest joy comes with the greatest reverence of God. David is perhaps as joyful now as he has ever been in his life because of the vision he has had of the glory of God and because he has been reminded that God is gracious through atoning sacrifice. Well, the ark is brought into Israel with great joy, and we'll get back to that to wrap up here just momentarily, but there's a little interjection here in verse 16. As the ark of the Lord came into the city of David, Michal, the daughter of Saul, looked out of the window and saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, and she despised him in her heart. And they brought in the ark of the Lord and set it in its place inside the tent that David had pitched for it. He's prepared a place where they're going to keep it. And David offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. And when David had finished offering the burnt offerings and the peace offerings, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord of hosts and distributed among all the people, the whole multitude of Israel, both men and women, a cake of bread, a portion of meat, and a cake of raisins to each one. This is an extravagant celebration. I can't imagine he took less people this time than he had before, so we've got at least 30,000 people, 30,000 cakes, 30,000 pieces of meat, 30,000 cakes of raisins, all designed to celebrate the blessing of having the presence of God in their midst in Jerusalem. Then all the people departed, each to his house. And David returned to bless his household. But Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet David and said, "How the king of Israel honored himself today, uncovering himself before the eyes of the servants, female servants, as one of the vulgar fellows shamelessly uncovers himself." She had not been impressed. Now, growing up, I always heard that her problem with David was that he had engaged in some sort of inappropriate nakedness, that he hadn't been wearing enough. But in studying more, I don't think that was her problem. I think her problem was that she thought he should have entered the city dressed in regal dignity. He should have been wearing his most royal attire. And, you know, in those days, grown men didn't even run, let alone dance in front of other people. It was considered undignified, unless you were a warrior or something. But so she just thought he had acted in a way unbefitting of a king. What are you doing wearing an ephod and dancing out where everybody can see you? And David said to Michal, "It was before the Lord who chose me above your father and above all his house to appoint me as prince over Israel, the people of the Lord, that I dance. And I will make merry before the Lord. I will make myself yet more contemptible than this, and I will be abased in your," or some translations say my, "eyes. But by the female servants of whom you have spoken, by them I will be held in honor." And Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child to the day of her death. It might be tempting for us to judge this interaction between David and Michal based on our own experiences, perhaps in marriage, perhaps just as men or women. A man might be tempted to take David's side, particularly if he's felt dishonored by his wife at some point. A woman might be tempted to take Michal's side, particularly if she has felt her husband has acted dishonorably at times and needed to be called out. But we must not judge like this in this situation. That's not the main point. The main thing about Michal is not that she's a woman, or even specifically that she's David's wife in this moment. That's not the key feature that's emphasized about her. The main thing about her is that she resembles her father, Saul. You notice how every time she's mentioned in the passage, it's Michal, the daughter of Saul. Michal is associated with him who took himself too seriously. Remember, that was one of the features of Saul. He feared the people. He feared how people would look at him, what people would think about him. He took himself too seriously. And McCall took herself too seriously. And because of her association with David, for him to act in this way that she thought was dishonorable would look negatively on the king and on her. She too feared the people. Now, admittedly, McCall had experienced a lot of rough stuff in her life. She'd been given to David because of bad motives on her father's part. She had tried to help David and spare his life, and then had been taken away from him and given to another man who apparently loved her a lot. And then she had been dragged away from that man and brought back to David's household. She would have had a good reason to perhaps have some contempt for David. And perhaps contempt from other situations flowed out in this one. Perhaps the contempt that she had for him was really not about his dancing so much, but she was ready for a reason to hold him in contempt. We don't know. But ultimately, underneath all of it, I think with the way Scripture tells the story, her problem was that she was too much like Saul, who thought the king should be honored as a king. And David's response to her emphasizes, today wasn't about me being king. Today was about God being honored as God. I wasn't the most important king entering into Jerusalem today, McCall. God was. Today was about him. And if I can honor him in any way, I'll act even more contemptibly than this, if it will serve to honor God. It's not about me being treated as high and holy. It's about God being treated as high and holy. So, we might be like McCall too, if we shy away from exuberant worship simply because we don't want to be looked down on by people. Or if we look down on others who don't shy away from exuberant worship. If we take ourselves more seriously in any way than we take God seriously. Acting in an undignified manner was David's whole point. It wasn't that he was indecent, it was that he humbled himself as a lowly servant celebrating the king's homecoming. So he stripped himself of his kingly robes and his royal majesty in order that he might lead God's people in the praise God is due. And by the way, does that sound like anyone else? Letting himself be stripped of his robes so that he could lead God's people in heartfelt worship. That's what Jesus did for us. He walked right into the greatest indignity and shame so that he could lead us into worship. This passage, as we conclude here, thank you for bearing with me. This passage has been centered around the Ark of the Covenant. And as I mentioned, it was topped with the mercy seat, bearing the images of the cherubim, who were guarding the holy presence of God. Listen to how that Ark and that mercy seat are described in Exodus 25. 21 and 22. You shall put the mercy seat on top of the ark, and in the ark you shall put the testimony that I shall give you. There I will meet with you, and from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubim that are on the ark of the testimony, I will speak with you about all that I will give you in commandment for the people of Israel. Brothers and sisters, ultimately Jesus is the one who fulfilled the Ark of the Covenant. As his blood was spilled, as his once and for all sacrifice was offered, it was in Him, coming in human flesh, dying in our place, that God met with us. It was in Him coming, the Word made flesh, that God spoke and speaks to us. It was in Him that we meet a God whose fearsome holiness is terrifying to His enemies, but can be a cause of great joy to His faithful people. I mentioned earlier that this was not about us just going through the right forms of worship for our righteousness. Ultimately, this is pointing us to how we must draw near to God through His appointed means. And that appointed means is His Son, Jesus. To approach God outside of Jesus is a terrifying and terrible thing. But to approach God through Jesus is the greatest path of joy. The lesson David learned on this day 3,000 years ago points us forward to that lesson of drawing near to a holy God only through Jesus, who let Himself be stripped and humiliated as our sacrifice, so that He could ultimately lead us in triumphant procession into the New Jerusalem. Our God, thank You for making a way for us to be near You in joy, not in terror. Continue to teach us what attention to Your instructions for worship and for formal worship and for all of life, what those look like. Help us to live lives that ascribe to You the highest dignity, even when it means humbling ourselves in ways that seem very undignified, even when it offends our pride. Let us be eager if it will bring glory to You. Thank You for the joy of walking through this life with You because of Jesus. Amen.